Oregon is way out in front of the rest of the country in recognizing the breaking of old gender barriers. When you get a driver's license in Oregon, you get three choices, not two. Instead of just M or F, male or female, you can have an X put in that box for non-gender binary. This is a long way traveled from the 1960s when boys and men began to wear their hair longer, and some people complained you couldn't tell the girls from the boys. Our guest this hour focuses on younger people and their attitudes toward gender identity. Sociologist Barbara J. Risman is the author of Where the Millennials Will Take Us, A New Generation Wrestles with the Gender Structure. Again, Barbara Risman is a professor in the sociology department at the University of Illinois at Chicago, UIC. She's the author of a previous book called Gender Vertigo, American Families in Transition. Barbara Risman, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Oh, I'm very glad to be here. Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
So let's start with some of your work before the current book. What is gender vertigo? What did you mean by that?
What I meant by gender vertigo, and that book was actually written in 1998, was that we had reached a moment in changes towards gender equality for women where we had begun to see a kind of stall. We'd seen lots of changes through the end of the 20th century. And then those changes didn't stop happening, but the rate of those changes stopped happening quite a lot. And so the argument I made then, which I came to see true 20 years later, was that in order to really move forward on equality, we were going to have to live through a moment of vertigo, of being dizzy, of everything being really hard to understand and not very comfortable in order to get us the next step to a place that people really were equal, no matter what their sex or gender. And I think that's in some ways where we are right now with a Category X.
Okay, I was going to ask about whether the Me Too moment indicated some of that too.
I think so. I think the Me Too moment is less, though, about gender vertigo and more about young people having sort of a shock wake up that we weren't necessarily moving in the right direction. There's been a sense, I think, through the political era of the Obama administration that things were generally getting better and more equal on all sorts of dimensions, both gender and race. And then the election of an openly misogynist president who talked about grabbing women by the pussy shocked, I think, people to realize, I better speak up and say something, because if I don't, if we don't, this is never going to end. And so I think in that sense, the in some sense, the current moment of political backlash to movement towards gender equality is what led more to the Me Too movement happening right now.
In the past, you wrote and spoke of gender as a social structure. Meaning what?
Meaning that we are incorrect, and we're not going to actually understand what's happening if we think about gender only as my authentic identity. And I think that's what's happened in our everyday language. We have mixed up the concepts of sex and gender, that we almost use them as synonyms. And in fact, gender identity, what I feel is who I really am, a woman or a man, or even neither one of those things, is one part of gender, and it's a really important part of gender, particularly to each of ourselves about our own lives. But gender impact in society is far beyond that. Gender, just like every society has a political structure and an economic structure, every society has a whole structure around gender, which affects individuals, but it also affects what we expect from one another, what is acceptable from people in each different sex category, and it's also built in to the way we run everything from our religions to our workplaces. The notion that a worker can be at, in the old days, it was at his or her desk 40 hours a week, 50 weeks a year. In this modern era, it's really expected to be accessible 24/7. That can only really exist if at some deep level in our beliefs and the way we organize work, the best workers are people who have no moral or practical responsibility for caring for anybody but themselves, and maybe not even themselves. Well, historically, given how much more time and responsibility women have in caregiving, we have built an affirmative action policy for men and for anyone who doesn't have to care for other people, but most, that statistically going to be more likely to be men, for non-caregivers into the way we run our economy. And so when I say gender is a social structure, I mean gender is built into the way we run our society as a system of inequality that privileges historically men and for sure people who don't have to take care of other people.
Yeah, the expectation is still very much there that the women are going to be the ones who stay home with the children. And in fact, I think you had some details in here about men and their unwillingness to take paternity leave even when it's offered.
That is true. When paternity leave is offered, men are often unwilling to take it. But it's not necessarily because they don't really want to be good caregivers. It can also be because of the expectations that they will face at the office or in their workplaces. That is, their bosses will think they're not really committed to their jobs. They'll be on a daddy track or a mommy track. They'll be afraid they'll never get promotions. And so because the reason men won't take paternity leave is maybe because they're so worried about how people will see them.
So they
as men, as workers.
Right,
they're
concerned about some gender identity
achievers.
Here. Barbara Risman, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Where the Millennials Will Take Us. We'll talk about how millennials view gender structure when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're discussing gender and how we view gender, more specifically, how younger adults view gender. Barbara Risman, sociologist at the University of Illinois at Chicago, is our guest. She's the author of Where the Millennials Will Take Us, A New Generation Wrestles with the Gender Structure. You can join the conversation on the exchange. If you're a millennial in particular, we'd like to hear from you as we go through the conversation. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So the focus on millennials, Dr. Risman, is it necessary because they're so numerous or because their thinking on gender is that different from previous generations?
That's a great question. I think both. Partly the interest in millennials is because they are the young adults of today. That is, what they're doing, what they're thinking, that is, in fact, where our society is going. And so they're very, in that sense, at this moment in history, given they're the new generation taking off into their adulthood and into the labor force, that makes them very important to begin with. From my point of view, as someone who's been studying gender a long time and interested in the way in which things are changing, I do think they're a particularly interesting generation because they are both the children of the second wave of feminism. They are the, and if you will, the children of the gender revolution. And so to see how that has shaped who they are, I think, is really important. In addition, it's this generation that's pushing the new categories that you in Oregon are so in the cutting edge on, in terms of being able to have identities beyond man or woman. And so in that sense, they're a particularly interesting generation because not every generation comes up with a new way of thinking about sex and gender. In fact, you might say that very few have before them.
I would be fair to California, too. California has passed its law as well, allowing a non-gender binary on the driver's licenses. It just doesn't take effect until January 1st of 2019. So that
right.
is that
and
is
in fact, Washington State mm-hmm. also has passed a law just last month, but it is only this. It is for birth certificates, and it's only in retrospect. So everybody's doing it differently and on a different time frame.
Right. And I want to assure people who might be wrestling with why we even have these discussions right now. I mean, you really get right to the heart of it, Dr. Risman, when you strip all the overlay off in pointing out that we take the biological material that differs between human beings and create social categories out of that.
Absolutely. There are So when sociologists use this language, we often use three categories: sex, sex category, and gender. And gender is really a cultural category, and how it is that we organize society around categories that were at least originally tied to processes of reproduction. Mm-hmm. And so that's a big, in contemporary American society, the average female spends 2 years or less in the process of reproduction out of a lifespan that's somewhere between 70 and 80 years, depending on demographic groups. So that's a pretty small period of time to organize the rest of one's possibilities in life around.
True, yeah, when you think about it, I mean, if you're pregnant twice in your life, which is pretty much the national average now, that's 18 months out of your entire life.
It's 18 months, and for those of us who've been pregnant know that some of those 18 months are much more grueling than others.
Longer months.
So it's not even a full, like, 18 months you can't do anything else, right?
Right, right. So really interesting here, though, one of the things you point out in the book is we do tend to think in terms of feminine and masculine on one scale. And there's a great companion chart you show with that where you can depict femininity as one line and masculinity as another, and you can have varying degrees of either or both.
Absolutely. When psychologists first started thinking about these things, they actually thought about femininity and masculinity as opposites. And you could only be, you know, you were either very masculine or very feminine, but you couldn't possibly be both. But now, when psychologists and sociologists measure these kinds of personality traits, we think about two different kinds of traits. That is, someone can be very high on what we call femininity. You could also call nurturance or caring or empathy. And what we call masculinity, you could also call agency or leadership or effectiveness, rationality. And the truth is that it's the same person can be high on both of those at different times of the day. Maybe, you know, and people couldn't be low on both of them as well. And so that I think we have to make more complicated when we think about these ideas, to think about them not so much as stable personality traits, but how people operate, and that we all grow and learn and change. In an early study of my own, I looked at men raising children without wives. They were actually men who had been widowed or deserted. This was back in the 1980s, before, and actually 1970s, the data was collected, before there were very many men trying to have children without partners. And what I found was over time, as they raised children, they began to be and see themselves as more feminine kinds of people, because they were doing the work of caring. And so the more caring work you do, the more you come to see yourself as a caring person, and probably the more skilled you get at caring, which is, after all, how most of what we measure in femininity is about.
We're talking to Barbara Risman, a sociologist at the University of Illinois Chicago, about her book, Where the Millennials Will Take Us, A New Generation Wrestles with the Gender Structure. I want to point out, this is not just theory. I mean, you talk to a lot of people. Can you tell us about the research?
Absolutely. In this most recent book, I talked to 116, my team and I talked to 116 millennials, that young people who were born between the early 80s and the mid-1990s, the first generation coming of age, really, in the 21st century. We did long interviews between an hour and 3 hours. We asked them to tell us mostly everything about their life. They're called life history interviews. But we also did about half the interview specifically on gender. On the, we read them scenarios. We asked them about their own experiences. We asked them to give us feedback on how they felt about changes that were happening in the media. And so we did long interviews, and then we had those interviews typed and transcribed. And I used them, thousands and thousands of pages, to sit down and write this book about this generation. And what I found was that this generation is as divided as the rest of America. That is, there is no one kind of millennial. Even in my a sample, which is predominantly minority, so there's more non-whites than whites in it. It's a sample that is grew up mostly in working class families. They are, many of them are either college students or simply soon out of college, but most of them grew up in working class families, and they're urban. They're all, the sample was in and around Chicago, within this, some of the states and school LGBT centers nearby. It's a gender diverse sample, meaning that I have people who identify as women and men, but I also have people who identify as neither, and I have some transgender respondents as well. So it's even within urban sample, I got tremendous differences, that everyone did not have the same attitudes or beliefs about gender as it is, or even as it should be, as in the direction in which we should be heading. And so that, I think, surprised me more than anything else.
We're talking again to Barbara Risben from the University of Illinois Chicago in the sociology department. She's written a book called Where the Millennials Will Take Us, A New Generation Wrestles with the Gender Structure. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about male, female, other, and all the places potentially in between. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. Wolfgang in Sunny Valley, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi there. Good morning. It's snowy. It's very white, actually.
It's also snowing in the Durham University in the UK, where I am for this semester.
Okay. Anyway, so I think when you talk to millennials, when you talk to young people, one of the things that has startled and dismayed me, actually, is the lack of historic knowledge that they have, or they are imparted. They don't get it. Nobody talks to them and tells them about historic context, about we've been here before and all that stuff. So having said that, and knowing that you are an academic who knows the difference between structure, construct, dogma, ideology, and all that, those are different animals. What I would like to do is take us back to what I know or perceive to be a beginning, I think a pivotal beginning, of questioning the biological binary of reproduction, and that is Genesis. Genesis is based on inventing or setting up or declaring a male to be creating life, right? Uh-huh. And everything else follows, I think. So what my question based on this, my question is, how do you think this fundamental rewriting of XXXY reality has affected history, has affected the difference of sex stereotype, like femininity versus female, right? Those are two different animals.
Mm-hmm.
that had, I think, there's a long view of that.
So the idea that man came first and created everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for that, Wolfgang. Appreciate it. Barbara, your thoughts?
I think that the how we think about creation stories and biblical information is important, but I think it's important in a metaphorical way. That is, I think that we have to think about what we can learn from the different interpretations of Genesis and biological reproduction as well. And I think that the stories about male and femaleness are very strong and very binary in most of traditional religions. And so I don't think that the ideas of this escaping one category or the other can be traced back to back that far. I do think that we began to want to say where I thought the caller was going to go was in the in Germany in the late 1880s, and in the beginning of the 21st century, there actually was the beginning of a great deal of transgender. I wouldn't call it activism, but scientific study and a little bit out of the closet and movement towards a modern view of at least critiquing some kind of binaries. And that, of course, was all destroyed and shut down with the rise of the fascism and Nazism. But in terms of history, I don't want to seem as if I'm saying that this generation is totally creating something new and different, just that their way of doing it seems to me a little new and different.
And again, the book is called Where the Millennials Will Take Us by Barbara J. Risman, who is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. So you eventually took your 116 interviews and put people into four categories, true believers, straddlers, innovators, and rebels. And I wonder how much difficulty you had just figuring out just four categories. Did it seem like sometimes there were going to be more, or how you'd label them?
Oh, I can't tell you how many different ways I tried to cut this data before I came up with those four categories. So, yes, it was a process of reading and rereading and organizing and reorganizing a great deal of textual data. I also do quantitative research where, with census data and survey data, and I must say this kind of analysis is even more time-consuming because you have to read through and thank God for computers and computer-assisted qualitative data packages these days, but try out looking at different patterns. But in the end, I really did see that I could really come up with four patterns, but one of them, as you will, let me tell you, your readers a little bit. Your readers, your listeners,
your readers,
a little bit,
or
what they are, and then you'll see. I sort of have one category at the end that is in, and all the others. So the true believers are people who, most of whom are raised in literalist faith traditions, the version of each of the major religions that think the Word of God is as it was written as opposed to is interpreted, and those people tended to be the true believers. That is, they thought men and women, males and females, should have different rules to live by, should have different opportunities and constraints, at least in their personal family situations. They did not resent it. And I had more women than men, and most of the and all of them had been raised. The women gave religious answers for why that was true. Most of the men gave biological answers for why men and women ought to be different. What was interesting, though, was among this generation, even the most conservative, who I call the true believers in the current gender structure, expected women to work for pay. There was no, there were the idea that the traditional family is male breadwinners and women who drop out of the labor force when they become mothers, that was not even part of the conversation with the true believers. And so in that sense, the kind of breadwinner-homemaker split has, for this generation, I think we will see moves more and more into the dustbin of history. Now, the women may choose jobs which they see as very feminine, jobs that are doing the kind of caring work in the paid labor force, but they expect to work for the vast majority of their adult lives. And so that, I think, was interesting about the true believers.
Okay, let's come back to the rest of the true believers and the other three categories in just a moment. The book is called Where the Millennials Will Take Us, A New Generation Wrestles with the Gender Structure, the work of the sociologist Barbara J. Risman from the University of Illinois at Chicago. We will talk more with Barbara and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Barbara J. Risman, a professor in the Sociology Department at the University of Illinois, Chicago. She has been exploring gender issues for years and takes a look at the generation coming up, the young adults of today, in a book called Where the Millennials Will Take Us, A New Generation Wrestles with the Gender Structure. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 about gender roles in today's world and gender structures and how we view gender generally. 800-838-3760 by phone. Email is jx@jeffnet.org. So, Dr. Risman, you were just talking about the true believers who sound generally religious and culturally conservative, and the men do believe that women should work, but the women often do what, for lack of a better term, some people would have once called women's work.
Absolutely. But they do it and expect to do it in the labor force, and I think that has implications for the future because those women won't become necessarily economic dependence on their husbands, and that is a pretty big change from true believers and conservative women in the past. But they were really, in the larger scheme of things, I think true believers are a very small part of the American millennial generation. I think the other three categories are probably much more common, and the next one I'd like to talk a little bit about is the innovators.
Uh-huh.
And the innovators are, in some ways, you might think of them as traditional feminists. They are against sexism. They're against men having options and opportunities that women don't have. They think men and women should share the work of raising their children and earning a living. But there is one difference, I think, in millennials, and that is in my generation, in the baby boom generation, feminism was a women's movement, and feminists were mostly women. In this generation, the interviews with the people I label the innovators are similar for men and women. That is, it's no longer only women who sound like this. There are a category of male millennials who are themselves as feminist as the women. And I think that is partly because culture changes slowly. These are probably men raised in a world where they've heard about women's rights, maybe even from their own mothers, for their whole lives. And so they don't react against it. It's not feminists against men. It's these innovators are women and men. And I think that's a hopeful sign in this generation.
I'm struck by the innovators and the fact that the things that even they, innovative though they may be, identified as of one gender or another, like speaking my mind was considered more of a male thing.
I think, no, the innovators absolutely identified as men and women.
Mm-hmm.
They were not category X people.
Sure.
But they totally rejected the notion that speaking my mind was more masculine than feminine, that it should have anything to do with masculinity and femininity. They were very proud of mixing and matching their personality traits, that the men were proud of not only were being caregivers and crying when they needed to and having intimate friendships with where they could talk about their feelings. And the women were very proud of being tough and aggressive as well as being caregiving. And so that the innovators were very self-conscious about trying to integrate the best of what has in the past been called masculinity and femininity into just being good people.
Okay, well, then let's move on to the rebels. I mean, within that group, or for that matter, any of the groups, did you find a lot of variety even within the groups?
I did, although it wasn't that big a group. Why I called them rebels is because these are people, and we started this conversation by my saying gender was not only about what we did as individuals, but also what we expect from each other and how we organize our institution. But for these people, the individual level was very important because they were just like the innovators, plus they didn't just reject the notion of gender personalities and opportunities and inequality. They rejected the notion that simply being female or male means that you should dress and use and be in your body in a different way. So they were people who, if they'd ever had, of course, I collected the data in 2012 and 13, so the phrase Category X had yet to be invented. But I have no doubt that some of them would call themselves Category X and by now would be using gender-neutral pronouns, either singular theys or her or zur or another choice of pronouns. But these were people who, just because they were male or female or transgender, didn't think they had to present themselves as feminine or masculine. And so they would some of them would be dressed in ways that were more masculine one day and feminine another. Others were females who wore very masculine clothing and saw themselves as very androgynous because the body was a female shape, the clothing was a male design, and therefore they were in the middle. They were. It is interesting that the women, the female genderqueer people in this sample, were very often mistaken for boys. So they told stories about being often mistaken for boys because of the way they dressed. And I had one man who was genderqueer who liked to wear heels. He would occasionally, he just hated always having to find dark clothing. I mean, he would say, "What is it about being male that means you can't wear bright, beautiful colors?" And so they were using their bodies in ways that rejected their gender. Although this group of people, that most of them, did not reject their sex category. They would say they were female or male, but their gender was queer. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of...
I want to point out that term is self-applied too, genderqueer, right?
Excuse me?
That term is self-applied, isn't it? Queering of gender?
Yes, absolutely. That's and when I was doing this research in 2012 and 13, it was still a term not nearly as widely known and used as it is now. And so this group of people, I think, is truly a millennial a phenomenon. Mm-hmm. This the rejection of the categories themselves, and there have been transgender people throughout history, and people who were born and labeled as one sex category and lived their lives as another gender forever. Those people were often lived within a binary. They just were in the category that they hadn't been so labeled at birth. These folks that are different than that. They don't want to change the category from the one they were labeled at birth. They just don't want to be locked into either of these categories. And that, I think, that my next book, actually, which I've already started collecting data for, will be specifically on these between the binary young adults, because I thought this was something new and different. And then the final category is what I call the Strabblers, or they're still in this age that psychologists now call emerging adulthood, which is an age where it ends around 30. And so the idea is that in a postmodern, post-industrial world, people sort of struggle with identities and struggle with sort of moving into adult, stable work and relationships and families through their 20s. And the group that I call the Strabblers are people whose you would read through the interview and couldn't quite believe the same person had said something about themselves, but then when they talked about what they expected from other people, it was the opposite. And then when they talked about how they thought gender should be, it wasn't at all consistent with who they said they were. And so there was this air of confusion. And I think that's really, I have a lot of empathy for that, because we live in a world where there's been lots of changes, but not everything has changed, where you can go out on a date with one person who expects, you know, the man to be the person who pays for everything and makes all the decisions, and you can go out on a date at another date where people expect everyone to be paying for themselves and be egalitarian, and you never know the person you're going to meet, you know, tomorrow, what they're going to expect when it comes to gender, because the change is so both strong and also uneven. And so there's just a lot of people left who are confused and are still working through a consistent way to deal with the gender structure.
I do find myself wondering, as we talked particularly about the Strabblers just now and some of the inconsistencies you found in the things they said, were the people generally under the age of 30? And what did you gather about their status of relationship, whether they're in one or not?
Everyone in my sample was under the age of 30 when I interviewed them.
All right.
So that was because of it, when I interviewed them and the generational status. The other half of your question was their relationship status. Most of these people were not yet in relationships. There were very few married. Mm-hmm. There was only one mother, some of whom had boyfriends and girlfriends. One or two were engaged. But most of them were still in that moment where they were figuring out what they wanted from relationships and with whom they would end up in a relationship. In contemporary American society now, the average age of first marriage is up over 25. It's actually about 27 for those people who go to college. And so, you know, this moment of being both a legal adult and footloose and fancy free from relationships, for many people, goes right through the mid-20s and even into the 30s.
I wonder if you kept contact information, if there's any thought in your mind about doing a longitudinal sort of study, where you'll come back and see them again in 10 years after the first set of interviews to see what their attitudes might be then.
That, you know what, that would have been a great idea. I didn't keep contact information, partly because of the way we promised them confidentiality. We didn't actually ask any of them their real names. We wanted them to be very free to say anything they wanted to say and never feel like it could ever be attributed to them. And so the way we collected the data makes that very difficult.
I want to come back to one final thing here, Dr. Risman, which is it was actually in the Rebels group. And as you list the traits for each of the groups, True Believers, Innovators, Rebels, Straddlers, the first two groups, the True Believers and the Innovators, had the I don't think my body's good enough labeled. Now, the Rebels don't. That's really interesting to me.
They don't because for them, their bodies are a work in progress, and there's something they're very proud of using differently, you know, in using in such a way as to defy stereotypes. And so they talked less about, they had talked a lot about using their bodies, but it was tinged with a kind of effectiveness, that they're doing something very consciously with how they use their bodies. But that's a very good catch. Thank you for reading so carefully.
Sure. There's an interesting set of...
I do want to end by saying there is something that I found pretty similar across all these groups mm-hmm. that I do want to leave you thinking about, and that was they all grew up in the same historical and political era, which is often called a neoliberal one, where there's a lot of emphasis on the self and mm-hmm. the individual responsibility.
Right.
And so most people felt like if they were going to make change, they were going to do it from how they lived their lives.
Mm-hmm.
But B, they were also quite libertarian.
Okay.
In the sense of whatever they wanted, they didn't feel like they wanted or needed to impose on anyone else.
Okay, Barbara Risman, we have to go. Where the Millennials Will Take Us is the book. Thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.